May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Again, Your Honors, thank you. Christopher Baumann for Blitz, Bargy & Deutsch, and the relator in this case. In May of 1996, the parties to this case entered into a lease for a training facility in Earth City, Missouri. 20 years later, the Rams football team, defendant before the trial court in this case, chose to relocate away from St. Louis. One among the effects of that move was that the training facility lease in this case expired. Contained in the training facility lease, Section 38, is an option provision that allows the Rams in approximately 8 years to purchase the training facility for $1. My client, relator in this case, filed suit for declaratory judgments stating that the option provision is no longer in effect or is invalid as a matter of law. The Rams moved to compel arbitration on the same day that they filed arbitration. We moved to stay arbitration, and that leads us to today. Missouri cases are legion that a court faced with an arbitration provision takes two steps. The first is to determine if there's a valid arbitration agreement. The second is then to determine whether the dispute issue is covered by the arbitration agreement. And I would propose to follow those same two steps during my argument today. The often repeated standard that relator relies on with respect to the first step is that an arbitration agreement lacks consideration if it purports to contain mutual promises, yet allows one of the parties to unilaterally divest itself of an obligation it otherwise promised to perform. Missouri courts have found that arbitration agreements that purport to have mutual promises are invalid if one party is allowed to unilaterally refrain from arbitrating those claims it is most likely to bring. That standard applies directly to this case, where the lease purports to set out mutual arbitration promises, but in fact gives the Rams the unilateral right to divest itself of that promise, not giving relator the same right. On those claims, the Rams may unilaterally divest, and the relator does not have that similar choice. The section I'm referring to is Section 41 of the lease. And that provides, in part, that if there is a dispute about the payment of money under the lease, a party may pay under protest and then, quote, institute suit for the recovery of such sum. The section also uses the word adjudged. All courts to consider that language, institute suit and adjudged, among other words that are used in the lease, has found that that is the language that refers to litigation, not to arbitration. So this section, 41, in effect, allows the Rams alone to divest itself of its purported mutual promise to arbitrate and unilaterally bring payment under protest cases in litigation instead of arbitration. The Rams do not have that right because there is no provision in the entire training facility lease under which relator is required to make any payment to the Rams. Given that this is a lease of real estate, disputes about the payment of money are very much the most likely claims that are going to occur under this lease. Those claims, only the Rams have the right to divest themselves of their promise to arbitrate. Relator has no such claim.
Opposing counsel cites a number of places where they say the obligations go both ways, and there could be obligations to pay money both ways. Do you disagree with that?
I disagree wholeheartedly, and I looked through every single one of those sections when I filed our reply brief, and I mentioned all of them. And there's a smattering of different sections. Two, for instance, assume damage to the training facility or condemnation of the training facility, in which case a third party makes a payment directly to the Rams. There are specific provisions in each of those that says the money does not come to us, nor do we pay it to the Rams. It goes directly from the third party to the Rams. There's an indemnification provision that provides for no payment. It's indemnity only. Set out in our reply brief, Your Honor, is every single one of those sections, and not one of them, nor any other section in the lease, requires the relator to pay money to the Rams. The only dispute that can come up under the payment under protest provision is a payment from the Rams to the relator. And that's precisely the basis, precisely the reason why this case falls within Green and Motormax and Jimenez.
And if we said that there has to be that in and of itself, a lack of mutual consideration requirements makes an arbitration provision unenforceable, or is that just one factor we look at?
I think it's more of a distinct factor. The Rams' main response to all of this is that our argument simply does not pass muster under the two Supreme Court cases, Eaton and Vincent v. Schneider, which is what I believe you're referring to. But that approach is too simplistic. It cannot be the case that Eaton and Schneider simply in some sense overrule Green and Motormax and Jimenez. First of all, in the Eaton case, the court specifically discussed Green and approved of it in the context of comparing it to Vincent v. Schneider and saying these are different. And then, of course, Motormax was decided after Eaton. Jimenez was denied transfer on the same day that Eaton came down. And the reason why they coexist, I don't believe they're factors to consider. I think they're two distinct issues. And this is how I understand it, particularly from reading Eaton. Number one, if you have an explicitly unbalanced arbitration agreement, you're clear about it. That is fine, so long as there is consideration for the entire contract. If, however, different situation, this situation, you have purported mutual promises to agree, but you sneak a provision into the agreement that says one side and one side only can divest itself. That's Green, that's Motormax, that's Jimenez, and it's invalid. That's how I understand the framework.
Thank you.
Your Honor, for those reasons, we ask on the first step for the court to issue its permanent writ and to declare that the court put the case back on its docket, to deny the motion to compel arbitration, and to grant our corresponding motion to stay arbitration. That takes me to the second step of the court's analysis, which is whether the claims at issue are contained within the arbitration agreement that's in the training facility lease. The review is de novo, and in relation to this step, the court seeks to determine the intent of the parties while giving weight and meaning to every provision of the training facility lease. Before every court, we've taken the position that the specific terms of this lease, some disputes are to be litigated and some disputes are to be arbitrated. And it's perfectly clear that declaratory judgments, the only claims that we brought in this case, are the types of claims that are to be litigated, not arbitrated. And that is primarily, though not exclusively, because of Section 30 in this case, a prevailing party provision that says, in any proceeding to enforce the terms hereof or declare rights hereunder, the prevailing party in such proceeding shall be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees and costs. The section also uses the word judgment. Again, this section is clear and unambiguous that any party who obtains a judgment on a declaration of rights is entitled to attorney's fees. And every court to look at this language has determined that when you have proceeding, when you have judgment, that is language that refers explicitly to litigation and not to arbitration.
And as I know you know, opposing counsel says that the Act uses the term arbitration proceedings, so proceedings could refer to either court or arbitration actions, and that the word judgment and so forth could refer simply to actions to enforce or contest what happens in an arbitration proceeding. Can you address those arguments?
Yes, ma'am. I agree that's what they say. I've got two major problems with that argument. Number one, just to say that the word proceeding could mean arbitration totally ignores the entirely separate prevailing party provision that's in the arbitration agreement. If proceeding in Section 30 means arbitration, why in the world are there two separate prevailing party provisions in this contract? There is no need for it. Second, Your Honor, with respect to the Act, and it's not just statutes, it's case law in which they say proceeding by itself means arbitration. That argument is wrong on its face, and I ask you to look again at their brief, because every single one of the examples that they give in statute or case law does not use the word proceeding. It says arbitration proceeding. That supports our argument. When the word proceeding is by itself, courts have always determined that that means litigation. Where arbitration is meant, the word arbitration is used, both in Missouri statute and in case law. So the factual basis for that argument, as far as I'm concerned, simply doesn't exist. Your Honors, there are three other sections of this lease that use the language of litigation instead of arbitration. Cumulatively, what these sections say, whether the standard is most forceful evidence or clarity or whatever you choose to name it, the intentions of these parties were that some disputes, including specifically and explicitly declaratory judgments, are to be litigated and some are to be arbitrated. It's not one, to its full. A case that no Missouri court has ever seen before, which the trial court stated, which the Court of Appeals stated. And when you have it four times, that is forceful evidence. It's not an accident. It's not without purpose. It's repetitive and it's meaningful. And the standard for this court and for the parties is not to try and come up with some fanciful notion of what a provision could mean and then throw up our hands and say, well, it's arguable. It must be arbitrated. The standard is to determine the intentions of the parties. And when in the training facility lease, not once, twice, but four times, the language of litigation is used instead of arbitration, including in one instance specifically saying any proceeding to declare rights, that means the parties intended for those claims, among others, to be litigated. And Your Honor, Section 30 does not just apply to the confirmation of arbitration awards by its own terms. It says any proceeding. If that's what the parties intended, they would use substantially different language. It says any proceeding to declare rights. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Roger Heitreich on behalf of the respondent. The RSA's request for a writ of mandamus should be denied as it is completely inconsistent with this court's decisions in Dunn and Eaton. Let me start with Eaton because that's the case that goes to the issue of whether or not there's a valid arbitration agreement here. The issue is raised here under the performance under protest clause that there's a lack of mutuality because the Rams are able, they say, to unilaterally divest themselves of the right to arbitrate. So is this a defense on lack of consideration, lack of mutuality, or is it a defense on unconscionability? They didn't really say which one it was. You didn't hear either of those terms. But it's of a lack of consideration. This court's decision in Vincent clearly addressed that issue. In Vincent, the court said, as long as the contract as a whole meets the consideration requirement, an arbitration clause in the contract will not be invalidated for a lack of mutuality of obligation. That was decided by this
court. But Eaton made clear lack of mutuality is very relevant in the determination. It's simply not in and of itself dispositive.
Correct. So lack of consideration is not a defense. The only thing that it can be relevant to is the unconscionability defense, which this court took up in Eaton. And in Eaton, the court, relying on the case in Vincent, said, well, lack of mutuality alone is not sufficient to make it unconscionable.
Can you please address the distinction your opposing counsel raised that here there was not an express imbalance, which the parties knowingly entered into a contract that contained those terms, but it appeared to give mutuality and then take it away, and that's an important distinction from these prior cases?
Well, a couple of things about it. First, it's just wrong on the facts, and it's wrong on the language of the contract. There are mutual promises to arbitrate here. Standing alone.
But if one is illusory, then is that a mutual promise, and does that change the dynamic in the analysis?
And what makes it illusory, according to the RSA, is the performance under protest clause. That clause also doesn't apply just to the Rams. That clause is also a mutual clause and talks about payments. It's an issue
And are there other payments directly to them? They said all these payments clauses that you refer to just refer to third parties, payments to third parties.
No. And in fact, this is a 20-year lease between sophisticated commercial parties. The idea that there might be money exchanging hands in both directions
and
is certainly
where's,
not.
And where's the provision that says you would pay them that they can bring? Where's the provision that you might pay them under protest? Where's the comparable provision? They're saying none of them are the same.
There could be any number of things.
But there could be,
One provision, if I might, Your Honor, is the way in which this training facility was at first constructed. The Rams gave $2 million to purchase the land, gave the land to the RSA, and then the RSA constructed. That provided all sorts of possibilities in which money might exchange hands, and in fact did exchange hands under this very contract. So there are many ways in which it could be done. The issue here is, does this unilaterally, does this clause, this performance under protest clause, unilaterally divest the right of the Rams to arbitrate? The clause even mention arbitration. Does not say a word about it. Doesn't refer to the clause. Doesn't say that the Rams don't have to arbitrate. Doesn't say those words at all. And for that reason, the case is entirely different. The allegation here is, in fact, the analysis is that, well, this is a snuck-in clause, like Eaton. Eaton's not a snuck-in clause. In Eaton, what the court analyzed there was a anti-waiver provision of the arbitration clause. It referred to the arbitration clause directly. There were self-help remedies that the lender could use. And it was that anti-waiver provision that directly related to the arbitration clause that the court found unilaterally divested the right of the lender to arbitrate all those things, but those things that were, which were important to it. And that's the big difference. There's a reason why. And so the analysis was in that case, Your Honor, an unconscionability analysis. There's a reason why I don't want to mention unconscionability here, because this was a commercial contract between sophisticated parties represented by able counsel. And the idea that you could make an unconscionability determination just doesn't fit under these sorts of circumstances. There's another thing about the Eaton case that I think is also interesting, Your Honor, and that is that in Eaton, even though the self-help provision was found to be unconscionable, you did not conclude that the arbitration agreement was unenforceable. Instead, what you did in that case was say, well, there's a severability clause here, and we're going to sever the anti-waiver provision, and we're going to go ahead and enforce arbitration. There's a severability clause in this contract, too. It's paragraph 18. And so even if you would somehow find that that language, which doesn't relate to arbitration, somehow does and somehow limits arbitration, you'd still enforce arbitration.
Can you address the Declaration of Rights language in the contract?
Of course. This is a broad arbitration agreement under Dunn. I don't think there's really any question. We begin
with
that.
You know, in labels broad and narrow and everybody's fighting, just what does it say and what does it mean is more helpful, I think.
And the reason why I point that out, Your Honor, is that it's important to the analysis. But here's what that language means on declaring rights. It is an attorney's fees provision. It's a prevailing attorney's fees provision. What they've done is to take a couple of words out of the language. Once again, that language says nothing about the arbitration clause or limiting the arbitration clause in any way. You won't find those words there. They take words out of the arbitration clause, declare rights, proceedings, judgment, and then string them together to say, well, that must mean that actions to declare rights are excluded from the arbitration clause. But proceedings don't just refer to court proceedings. They also refer to arbitration proceedings. Arbitrators declare rights all the time. Now, the word judgment is something that applies, that's something that courts do. Now, the arbitration clause, however, uses the word judgment too. And here's what it says about judgments. Right after it talks about the incorporation of the AAA rules. And judgment upon any award rendered by the arbitrator may be entered by any federal or state court having jurisdiction thereof. Judgments follow arbitration.
But you don't declare rights when you're trying to enforce a judgment. A declaration of rights is entirely different than filing to obtain money that you've been ordered to pay in arbitration or be paid.
But the underlying award may be a declaration of rights. And I'm not sure I would agree that the confirmation of an arbitration award is not, in a sense, a declaration of rights.
This well, it case, says declare rights here under the lease, and you're saying it only applies to filing to enforce an arbitration award. Those are very different things, aren't they?
I don't think so, if the underlying issue is a declaration of rights. But what this provision allows is a party who has received an arbitration award to go into court and to get its prevailing fees if it prevails in the confirmation hearing. That's what it does. It is very similar to this court's decision in Dunn. In Dunn, the change order reserved remedies provided by law. And the court said, that must refer to some unspecified rights. And one of those unspecified rights was the right to get a confirmation hearing. Specifically, the court used the confirmation of hearings as a way in which to reconcile the clauses, and that's what it should do here. And this gets me back to the point, Your Honor, about it being a broad arbitration clause, because the issue is it within the clause as it's asserted? Clearly it is, right? This is a dispute.
Why are there two attorney's fees clauses, then one applicable to arbitration and the other to something else where you're seeking a declaration of rights?
For just the reason I mentioned, that if you went into court to confirm this award, if you went into court to fight somebody who had just breached the arbitration agreement, if you went into court because public policy did not permit a particular claim to be arbitrated, this clause would apply. That's why it's there. That's why it's there. It's perfectly reconcilable. And what they've got to show, in the words of the Dunn case, is that this clause clearly, positively, unequivocally, and decisively limits arbitration. Does it do that? It doesn't do that at all. It doesn't even mention arbitration. And neither do any of the other provisions. The performance under protest.
Well, that presumes something else says arbitration covers this. I mean, if it's a question of what's arbitration intended to cover, then they don't have some burden to dispute that arbitration applies unless you first show arbitration otherwise covers a declaration of rights.
Well, and we've certainly shown that it covers this dispute. This dispute is a dispute involving the lease, the validity of the purchase option. It's clearly within that broad language. And so then the issue is there an express provision excluding the arbitration, and there isn't, or is there other forceful evidence? And they haven't provided anything like that here. This provision does not purport to limit arbitration at all, and instead is simply a prevailing attorney's fees provision for those items in which there could be court-ordered litigation. And I gave three examples of where that might be.
Thank you.
The performance under protest language is something else they relate to. Again, they just pull words out of it. That contract language, again, doesn't refer to arbitration and also doesn't involve this dispute. There isn't some payment of money that they're trying to fit this into. The same thing is true of the forum selection clause. What does that language do in terms of pulling this dispute out of the arbitration provision? Nothing. Rather, it provides the location of this confirmation hearing. The final provision that they relied upon was the cumulative remedies provision, which is very similar to the language in the change order in Dunn, which said that no remedy or election hereunder shall be deemed exclusive. Sounds like it's a problem until you add the language that says subject to the arbitration provision. It's set forth in paragraph 45, which really reinforces my position that the arbitration provision is, as it says, the exclusive dispute mechanism between the parties. So for these reasons, Your Honors, we would ask that the writ of mandamus be denied and Judge Burton's order compelling arbitration be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank
Your Honors, no section of this lease provides for a payment from relator to the Rams. They have been unable to name any. The only thing that he mentioned was some payment that I've not heard of that is explicitly not in evidence in this case. And I would ask you to look at pages 20 to 21 of our reply brief, where I go through every section that they name and show that there is no payment from relator to the Rams. Your Honors, again, we've come up with some ideas of what Section 30 could mean. Perhaps it means fees if you wrongfully file litigation. No, it doesn't, because there's an arbitration provision that already applies for fees in an arbitration. If they want to, if there's a wrongful filing, they can file a claim in arbitration for a wrongful filing, and the arbitrator is explicitly allowed to give them attorney's fees in language that is not ambiguous and does not refer to litigation. It says, in the event of any such arbitration, the prevailing party shall be awarded its cost and reasonable attorney's fees as part of the award. That is why there are two separate provisions, because some are litigation, some are arbitration. And they also say we need Section 30 because there are some public policy things that can't be arbitrated. That is absurd. First of all, the section of statute that they cite to doesn't say that certain claims are excluded from arbitration. It says certain types of contracts. But if their argument was true, that means every contract in the world would have to have two prevailing party opinions if there's an arbitration provision. One for arbitration, one for litigation. We've all seen thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of contracts, and you never see them because their argument is simply not true. There is no statute that requires any contract to have two separate prevailing party provisions. Your Honor, finally, but
are you making an unconscionability argument, as they say you are, or are you making a lack of consideration, failure of consideration argument?
Your Honor, it literally was just coming out of my mouth. We don't mention unconscionability because the way that I read it, although we did use unconscionability / lack of consideration in front of the trial court, there's some cases that seem to blur the two. We don't mention it because it doesn't seem to me to be an Eaton unconscionability case. And I'm reading from Eaton, where it talks about Green, and it says the promise to arbitrate in Green was illusory. It allowed the dealer to divest itself of this aspect of the agreement, which held that an arbitration provision that permits the seller to unilaterally change the terms of arbitration and unilaterally divest itself of the obligation to arbitrate lacks consideration. That is my argument. There are cases that sometimes seem to say that mutuality of consideration and unconscionability are one and the same thing. But all I'm doing is following Eaton that approves of Green and says there's a lack of consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's a well-argued case.